Good afternoon. It's hard to be graceful up here. Good afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. This is our afternoon session and we have one case to be orally argued. And we'll go ahead and get started if that's okay. And I'll ask the clerk to read the case and call it. Okay, thank you. Ms. Hyman, are you ready to proceed? Okay.
May it please the court.
Counsel?
Your Honor, AT&T Texas and Newtalk were parties to an arbitration in front of the Texas Public Utilities Commission, which we'll refer to probably as the PUC here, if that's all right. And it was started because Newtalk obtains telephone services wholesale from AT&T Texas. And AT&T Texas had threatened to cut off Newtalk's access to these services. And so Newtalk filed a proceeding with the Texas Public Utilities Commission to stop that from happening. AT&T Texas then filed a counterclaim for breach of contract, seeking regular common law breach of contract damages. And over Newtalk's repeated objections that the PUC does not have authority to grant an award of breach of contract damages or to hear a breach of contract case, the PUC issued an arbitration award saying that AT&T Texas was entitled to $12 million from Newtalk. AT&T Texas then could have gone to court to try to enforce that arbitration award, but it didn't. What it did was file a brand new proceeding, a separate proceeding, with a common law breach of contract claim. By proceeding that way, they were required to prove the elements of a breach of contract claim: an agreement, their own actions under the contract, the breach, the damages.
Okay, can I ask you, interrupt there
of course.
For a moment? So what happened, what happened to the arbitration award when they didn't bring a proceeding to confirm or enforce it? What's the status of it after that? Does it disappear?
No, it's still out there. I mean, the PUC does have jurisdiction to basically act, to do a declaratory judgment type claims to the extent that the PUC declared the rights of the party having to do with, for example, whether AT&T Texas could cut off Newtalk. There were some credit issues that were decided, those kinds of things. It's a binding arbitration award between the parties. What we're saying is that as to this breach of contract claim, the PUC never had authority to enter the award, and so it certainly, therefore, couldn't act as have a preclusive effect in a breach of contract claim, a separate breach of contract claim in a separate proceeding.
Okay.
So, as I said, AT&T Texas, by bringing a breach of contract claim, was required to prove an agreement, its own performance, breach, and damages. It moved for summary judgment in the lower court, and instead of having any evidence whatsoever of the breach or the damages, an affidavit, billing records, anything like that, all it did was say, look at this award we already got from the PUC. In other words, we have proven our elements of our breach of contract claim by way of this prior decision of the PUC. And we, Newtalk, objected again that the PUC did not have authority to make binding fact findings or legal conclusions in a common law breach of contract claim, and certainly when we had requested a jury, that they were entitled to a jury or that the court would make its own findings. But the court didn't make its own findings in a summary judgment context. We weren't given the right to a jury. All the court did was say, yes, this has already been decided. It's entitled to res judicata and collateral estoppel preclusive effect. So we have several bases, therefore, for this appeal. One is that the there wasn't summary judgment evidence. There was not admissible summary judgment evidence before the court to establish the elements of the cause of action. The second...
Did the trial court rule on either side's objections to the other's summary judgment evidence?
Not expressly, Your Honor, no.
Not. Okay, not in a written order or orally.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Was the record from the PUC hearing introduced? Wasn't it a three-day hearing?
The transcript itself? I do not believe so, Your Honor. Okay. Just the decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so I guess some of the pleadings, but not the hearing, record of the hearing.
But didn't the trial court, didn't the PUC panel, the arbitration panel, determine the amount that AT&T claimed was owed?
It issued an order finding the amount that AT&T said it was owed. Yes, it did.
Okay.
And our position is that finding, it was not entitled to make that finding, or if it was entitled to make that finding, that finding cannot serve as the basis for it is not entitled to preclusive effect to serve as the basis of a summary judgment in a separate breach of contract proceeding. And I'll point out, Your Honor, that AT&T has cited many, many, many cases for the general proposition that under some circumstances, agency decisions are entitled to preclusive effect. They didn't cite one single case, not one, holding that an elements of a breach of contract claim in a common law breach of contract lawsuit in state court in Texas can be met just by pointing to a PUC decision, or for that matter, any agency decision. The main case they rely on, GTE versus PUC, which in their brief they describe as, quote, affirming damages based on the PUC's finding that Verizon owed $10 million under an interim in connection agreement. That was not a breach of contract lawsuit like this is. That was a proceeding that was a direct challenge to the PUC's order, which one can do. You can take the PUC order and then go to court and say, you know, I don't like this PUC order, court, you need to review it. The court reviews the legal conclusions de novo and reviews the factual findings for arbitrary and capricious standard. That was that type of proceeding. And there was a challenge in that case to the PUC's jurisdiction. It wasn't our sort of case. In that case, there was a question as to whether the agreement between the parties, between Verizon and MCI, that was under review was a final agreement or just an interim agreement, and that's what the parties were fighting on the jurisdiction. It doesn't appear in that case that anybody raised any challenge as to whether the PUC could decide whether one party owed the other party money and order the and let alone whether that finding would then be entitled to preclusive effect in a subsequent breach of contract claim.
Okay, so why didn't, though, there are some similarities, why didn't Newtalk do the same thing that the complainant in the GTE case did?
We could have, Your Honor. It just would, as a matter of our decision-making for our client, I don't want to get into it because obviously it's privileged, but we chose not to do it that way. Okay. There are two cases that you've seen that we rely on for the proposition that the PUC does not have the authority to award money damages or to make a finding about money damages. One is Penny versus Southwestern Bell. That's a Fifth Circuit case. That case, the court expressly held that the PUC does not have the power to remedy past wrongs, that the PUC can declare the parties' rights and the meaning of the parties' agreement and order how they shall behave going forward, but does not have the power to remedy the past wrongs. And the court goes on to say that while the trial court, and they use the phrase reach out and touch, because throughout that opinion, I don't know if you've seen it, they have a lot of little jokes having to do with AT&T's advertising campaigns, but the court may reach out and touch the PUC's expertise, and then this is the key quote, and then use the PUC's determination as a basis for determining whether and what types of damages are appropriate in a particular case. Well, that didn't happen here. The trial court here did not use the PUC's award as a basis for making its own determination as to whether and what type of damages are awarded here. The court just said, that's already been decided, you're finished. And that's not what Penny says you can do. The other,
how do you know that for sure when you said yourself the decision was entered into evidence, and it's my understanding that the decision was some 48-page or some long document that really went through the various positions of the parties. How do you know the trial court didn't take that into consideration?
Well, the court may have taken, I think the court did take it into consideration, but just accepting it on its face value, not making any effort to look beneath it. And the reason the court couldn't have looked beneath it is that the evidence beneath it wasn't before the court. The only thing before the court was the opinion itself, not any billing records, not any affidavits, not, I mean, there's not even an affidavit saying, I'm, you know, from AT&T, I say that you didn't pay us this money. I mean, there's nothing like that in the record at all. In fact, when I was preparing for oral argument, I went back thinking maybe I'd missed it. Surely it was there. It wasn't there. All they said was, this ruling that somebody else made, you are bound by it. The res judicata collateral estoppel effect of it is that we will not look at this again at all.
Well, I thought that Neudog is the one, though, that first invoked the PUC's power and authority and asked it to make this determination.
No, Your Honor, we asked it to keep them, to enjoin AT&T from cutting off our service. The AT&T has pointed to, claiming that it is us invoking the jurisdiction, is there was a request for some credits, not a payment of cash, but for some credits, and a request that AT&T be directed to return our money that they were holding as a deposit. But there wasn't a request that the PUC award damages. And more importantly, Your Honor, even if we had done that, which we didn't, the parties can't create jurisdiction. I mean, we all know that. So even if we had said, you know, please make them pay us a lot of money, which we didn't, that wouldn't answer the question of whether the PUC has authority to award money damages, because that's a question of jurisdiction that the parties can't waive.
Okay, so what you're saying should have happened is AT&T should have filed a motion to enforce the arbitration agreement, the PUC's arbitration agreement?
Your Honor, I think they had two options. One, that is one, absolutely, and I think having chosen instead to file a breach of contract claim, then they needed to have evidence of the breach when they filed for summary judgment.
Okay, so if they filed a motion to enforce the arbitration award, how would that be any different from essentially what they have done? I mean, isn't it kind of a distinction without a difference?
Well, to us, it's not, because even in that procedural context, we would still be taking the position that the PUC doesn't have the authority to order us to pay money damages to AT&T, and that we were entitled to
The PUC didn't order anybody to pay. At least looking at the arbitration award that is in the record, it looks like what the PUC did was determine an amount. What amount is owed AT&T due to Neutalk's failure to timely pay for services rendered? And the PUC determined an amount, but there's no order saying pay this amount to AT&T, and that was accomplished by the summary judgment in the trial court. So I'm not seeing a distinction procedurally between what you say should have happened, which is a motion to enforce the arbitration award, and what actually did happen.
Your Honor, I'm kind of giving AT&T the benefit of the doubt, because it sometimes says that the PUC found an amount of money and awarded an amount of money damages, and sometimes it doesn't. To the extent one reads the PUC order to make a finding an award of money damages, then what one does then is file a motion to confirm an arbitration award. To the extent, and we're on agreement with you, Your Honor, that the PUC did not do that, that all it did was find an amount due, which again we believe violates our right to a trial by jury, then perhaps what Southwestern Bell did is correct, and that it did need to file a new breach of contract claim, but then it needed to prove the elements of that cause of action. And we don't think that it can prove the elements of that cause of action by directing the trial court to a PUC order when that PUC order was entered without jurisdiction and without giving us our right to a trial by jury on findings of fact under the Texas Constitution.
But isn't that true of every arbitration award? That if the parties agree to arbitration, which I think they did, at least it looks like they did here, they generally give up their right to a jury trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. And had we entered into an agreement to have a binding arbitration on the question of breach of contract with a waiver of the right to a jury trial, that's exactly where we'd be, just like any other arbitration. But that's not what we did. Newtalk did never agreed that the PUC could hear a breach of contract claim and award money damages. We objected all throughout the proceedings and over and over and over, and objected again in the trial court for using that opinion in that way, because we had not agreed. And again, Your Honor, I think, as you say,
your time is up.
Save it for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Theis? Did I say that right, Theis? Theis, I'm sorry. For AT&T.
May it please the court.
Counsel.
Newtalk hasn't paid its bills to AT&T for years, and that's really all that this case is about, Newtalk's failure to pay its bills. And we litigated the issue before the Texas Public Utilities Commission. For about a year, we exchanged discovery. We produced documents, did requests for admissions, took depositions, and we had a 3-day evidentiary hearing before the PUC. Each party presented testimony to the PUC, presented argument to the PUC, and at the end of that hearing, the PUC entered an award. And it wasn't some perfunctory one-page decision. It was a 42-page decision in which the PUC looked through each one of the arguments and went argument by argument, and it resolved each one of the disputes, each one of the claims that had been asserted. Now, once the PUC entered that decision, Newtalk had a couple of options. It could have moved for rehearing before the PUC, or it could have filed a lawsuit to appeal the PUC's decision. And instead, Newtalk did nothing. It didn't even pay its past due balance that the PUC said was owed to AT&T. So AT&T filed a lawsuit with the trial court, asserted a breach of contract claim, and the trial court granted summary judgment to AT&T based on that breach of contract claim. And the trial court's decision was correct for two independent reasons. Number one, Newtalk is bound by the PUC's decision and can't come in and dispute its substance.
Why? Did they agree that this was a binding arbitration? Do you have something in writing that's in the record in our case that says that this was a binding arbitration?
No, there's not a provision of the contract that says it's a binding arbitration. That comes from state agency law. So,
They didn't ask for reconsideration.
Yeah.
Do you have authority, case law authority, that says because they didn't ask for reconsideration, that means it's binding on them and they can't dispute it later on?
I do, Your Honor. It's not actually that they didn't move for a hearing, it's that they didn't appeal the decision. And that's State versus Triax Oil and Gas case. I'll give you a particular site for that. It's 966 Southwest 2nd, 123. And we discuss that at pages 13 and 14 of our brief. And what the court said in that case is, an agency's decision is like a judgment. If you don't appeal the decision, then you're stuck with it. And it says you can't offer any defense to the substance of the decision. You can't dispute it. You can't offer even valid defenses to the substance of that decision.
Well, what about a counterclaim for the long distance damages? Was that incorporated into the arbitration award, or are they precluded from asserting it?
They wasn't encompassed by the arbitration award. That counterclaim, which they asserted and was still part of the case until recently, the PUC has jurisdiction over that. And so actually within the last 2 weeks, the trial court abated the lawsuit so that that counterclaim could be presented to the PUC first if Newtalk decided to do that.
I guess that was going to be one of my questions, was what remains in the trial court after the severance, because we don't have what was severed out. All we have is this appeal.
So the only thing that remains in the trial court is their counterclaim, which has been abated for any PUC proceeding that New Talk chooses to file. What had been severed into the new proceeding was a summary judgment order which disposed of our breach of contract claim and their affirmative defenses.
Well, why didn't AT&T file a motion to confirm, file a proceeding to confirm the award?
I'm not aware of any procedure by which we can just simply move to enforce a PUC's decision. There's no procedural mechanism for that.
Okay, I guess I used the wrong word. But file a suit to confirm.
There's no procedural mechanism for that. We call it an arbitration award, but this isn't an arbitration award like under the Federal Arbitration Act.
Well, apparently that's what they did in State versus Triaxx Oil, is they filed a motion to enforce the Railroad Commission's order. That's not the same posture that y'all were in your case.
That decision provided for all of the relief that they were seeking to get. And those were administrative penalties that they were trying to enforce. Here, we didn't have damages in the decision, so we couldn't just enforce the award and get damages. We had to bring a separate breach of contract claim.
And so you had to prove your damages.
And we did, based on the PUC's decision. Given that they didn't dispute, they didn't file an appeal of the decision, there's no dispute. It is now fact that they owe us $12.2 million. And they can't raise any dispute to that.
They owe it and didn't pay it. That's a breach of contract?
Yes,
that's
Your
the
Honor.
Breach? I'm having trouble seeing the difference between the PUC's determination of the amount due and a common law claim for breach of contract.
We did claim that they violated the contract, and the PUC has jurisdiction over that. Now, there's one particular case that we cited in our brief. It's Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Public Utilities Commission of Texas. And the citation for that is 208 F3rd 475. And it was a decision by the Fifth Circuit. And in that case, the whole issue was whether the PUC had jurisdiction over the dispute. And the dispute was a breach of contract claim. And the court held that, yes, under federal law, under the Federal Communications Act, state commissions, like the Texas PUC, has jurisdiction to enforce the terms of a contract, of an interconnection agreement. And the particular dispute there was a breach of contract claim.
Yeah, I keep seeing that language of can enforce, but in fact, it doesn't seem to have the power to enforce, at least a determination, not specifically this case, but what power does the PUC have to enforce its rulings? Does it really? I mean, do the parties to a dispute that the PUC determines always have to file a lawsuit to get enforcement, collection, and execution, and so forth?
Well, typically parties don't refuse to comply with a PUC's decision. There's not a particular mechanism by which we can then say, hey, PUC, New Talk failed to comply with the terms of your decision, so we want some relief as a result of that. What the PUC does is it helps the parties to resolve their dispute, and it enters findings related to the dispute, and that's exactly what happened here. Now, and this isn't just a matter of state and federal law with respect to the PUC's jurisdiction. It's a matter of contract between the parties. In section 9.5.5 of the party's contract, which I've reproduced as Appendix Exhibit 1, the parties agreed that they could submit disputes to the PUC for resolution. And it says any dispute pertaining to the agreement, including billing disputes. And that's exactly what we had here, a dispute over billing. They thought that they were entitled to certain credits. They wanted a refund. They were indeed seeking monetary relief from us. And we wanted relief from the PUC with respect to their failure to pay. We wanted the court to look at the terms of the interconnection agreement and tell us whether New Talk was entitled to withhold payments from us, engage in self-help, which is exactly what New Talk was doing.
So basically, you needed to do something in the trial court to get a judgment, a money judgment that you could enforce.
Yes, Your Honor. If we had had a judgment, a money judgment from the PUC, we would have never needed to go to trial court. We would never be here right now. We would have gone and enforced that judgment and collected our money, but we didn't have that.
The PUC just makes a finding as to the amount.
That's what it did, yes, Your Honor. It told the parties what the past due balance was after it weighed the competing claims between the parties. And as I mentioned, there were two independent reasons why this court can affirm the trial court summary judgment decision. Was first the Newtalk's failure to appeal the decision of the PUC, and the other basis is claim and issue preclusion. The Texas Supreme Court on multiple occasions has said that claim and issue preclusion apply to agency decisions, and multiple courts of appeals have held the same exact thing.
Did the PUC address their statute of limitations claim?
In the decision, there's no discussion of the statute of limitations.
So you were able to ask for a finding concerning money damages before the PUC that you wouldn't have been able to claim even at that time because the statute of limitations had run, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat your question, please?
At the time that you were arguing for an amount of damages before the PUC, at that point in time, the statute of limitations had run and you would not have been able to file a case for breach of contract for those past damages, correct?
No, I disagree with that. We were within the limitations period.
It was filed in 2010?
The original proceeding was filed in 2010, correct, Your Honor.
And you were asking for damages up through 2008?
I believe it was 2009 through 2012.
So the damages were accruing as the PUC proceeding was proceeding?
Yeah, it was originally, Newtalk initiated the proceeding, and then we filed a counterclaim. And I don't believe it's in the record, but I do believe that Newtalk advanced the statute of limitations argument before the PUC. It was certainly entitled to bring a statute of limitations argument before the PUC. Nothing was precluding it from doing so. It's a provision of the contract, and so if they wanted to assert that defense, they were within their rights before the PUC to assert that defense. You can't get a decision, say, oh, I don't like that decision, and then turn around and start asserting new defenses once we bring a lawsuit based on that decision. Again, State versus Triox Oil and Gas says that if you don't appeal the decision, you cannot offer even valid defenses to the decision.
In a motion for enforcement of that agency's order, which is not what our case is.
It is not a motion to enforce the agency's order.
In Triox, really?
No, I'm saying our case is not a motion to enforce the agency's order.
Thank you.
Now, on the issue of preclusion, this case is tailor-made for preclusion. We went through a year-long litigation of our counterclaim. We engaged in discovery, full discovery. We presented evidence. We presented testimony to the PUC. They had every chance to make their arguments that they had, both evidentiary and based on their interpretation of the contract. And they submitted to the, we submitted the dispute to the PUC for resolution, and the PUC resolved it with a 42-page decision. It went through every single argument. It went through it in detail. And the whole point of claim and issue preclusion is that we are not going to waste judicial resources redoing disputes that parties have already litigated. And this applies, again, to agency decisions. You can't get an agency result that you don't like and just come into court and say, hey, let's have a do-over. You don't get a do-over. And
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry. It looks like on page 387 of the arbitration award, Newtalk issue number 6 Has AT&T exceeded the 6 months limitation period for back billing contained in the interconnection agreement? Is that different than the statute of limitations we're discussing for the breach of contract action?
Yes, Your Honor. There's a 1 year limitations period.
Thank you.
And the findings that the PUC made were very clear that the parties had a contract, that AT&T provided services under that contract, that New Talk violated the terms of the contract by refusing to pay the amounts owed, and that the amounts owed totaled $12.2 million. And those facts are sufficient to support AT&T's claim for a breach of contract claim. So whether we call it they're bound by the decision or claim or issue preclusion applies, either way, the trial court's decision on summary judgment was correct. We were entitled to our judgment that we received. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there a rebuttal?
Your Honor, the counsel for AT&T stated that we had, New Talk had every chance to raise its defenses that we raised in the trial court, and that's simply not the case. For one thing, as I've said many times, we did not believe that the PUC had authority to decide the parties, a breach of contract claim brought by AT&T Texas. And so it would have been inconsistent with our position to raise defenses to a claim that we thought the PUC didn't have authority to decide, because we then would have been asking the PUC to decide that. Secondly, Your Honor, so one of the defenses we had, obviously, was the statute of limitations. And Counsel for AT&T correctly noted that the discussion in the opinion is different. But AT&T's position in the arbitration, and it's on page 367 of the award, is that New Talk owes an unpaid wholesale service billings for the period May 2009 through March 2012, $13 million, and a long number starting with 13. Of this amount, $12 million plus is past due. The arbitration itself was filed in 2010, but AT&T didn't file its counterclaim seeking this unpaid amount due until November of 2011. So even if you give them the date that they filed the counterclaim at the PUC, some amount of this money from the period May 2009 through a year before November of 2011, because it's a 1 year period, is barred by the limitations. We actually also take the position that it's not any of those dates that starts their clock running. It was filing the lawsuit in the trial court, because we don't think that one can toll limitations by filing in the PUC if the PUC doesn't have authority to make that determination. The second thing I just wanted to clarify, and I think Justice Gabriel has already picked up on this, but just I don't want to leave it unsaid, that State versus Triax is a case where a party was trying to enforce an arbitration award or an award of a agency, a state agency. It's not at all our situation here, where a party has filed a new civil cause of action, a new civil common law cause of action, and is trying to use an agency's determination to meet its elements of that cause of action. And in fact, as I said before, they haven't cited the court to a single case, not one, where a party brings a breach of contract action and then is entitled to affirmative summary judgment, having proven as a matter of law its elements of its cause of action simply by pointing to an agency's determination. The second thing is, even if, we're not talking here about whether we're bound, we're talking about the preclusive effect. But if we were talking about whether we are bound, even under that doctrine, we're not bound if the agency didn't have authority to do what it did. And that is our position, is that the agencies didn't have the authority to decide the elements of a breach of contract claim, and in fact perhaps didn't, depending on what time you're listening to AT&T talk, but assuming it didn't, then we absolutely have the authority to challenge the award in a collateral way because it's void, and void orders can be challenged that way. Orders by an agency that has exceeded its jurisdiction absolutely can be challenged collaterally. And so we would have the right to do it that way. And I think this is perhaps most importantly, the trial judge granted summary judgment against Newtalk on its affirmative defenses. And these affirmative defenses were not things that we had raised in the PUC proceeding, not just limitations, but credit and offset. And Justice Gardner asked about our counterclaims. Our counterclaims, which are for money damages we believe due to us, are still proceeding. And so how the trial court could decide that we are not entitled to credit and offset as a matter of law when we had a claim pending that we believe we would have been able to offset or credit against the money due to AT&T, assuming there was some, that's unclear. I mean, and AT&T hasn't given any really explanation other than to point to the PUC's decision, but the PUC expressly severed out those same counterclaims on the long distance bundle and did not decide them. So the PUC was not in a position to decide whether there was credit or offset against the $12 million for the long distance bundle dispute because the long distance bundle dispute had not yet been decided. I might see my time is up. If no one has any questions, I'll.
Okay. No questions then.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you, too. Thank you all. This was a well-briefed case, and your case is submitted.